Welcome to Heavy Networking, the flagship podcast from the Packet Pushers. Find out more about our podcast network for IT professionals at packetpushers.net. All our shows, blogs, newsletters, and more are there and all free for you with no login required. I'm Ethan Banks, and with me is Drew Conray Murray. You can connect or follow us on LinkedIn, and please do. On today's episode, we step away from our loftier automation framework discussions we've had in recent episodes to get specific about a network automation practice. We are chatting with Michael Winston, Director of Network Architecture and Automation at Fiserv, one of the largest fintechs in the world. And fintech is dear to my heart. I spent 4 years of my career working on a payment card network. Joining Michael is Chris Wade, the CTO and co-founder of Itential, who is our sponsor today. In this discussion, we are going to consider Fiserv's automation practice, which didn't come all at once. They made a few attempts at automation and got some things wrong. And eventually, they worked through their challenges to get functioning automation off the ground. And that led to the need for orchestration, which is where Itential's platform came in. Michael Winston, welcome to Heavy Networking. And Chris Wade, welcome back. It's nice to have you both here. Michael, the first question goes to you. We got to set this up for us, man. Describe the Fiserv network. What business functions does the Fiserv network support?
Fiserv's network, as a global fintech, is responsible for global financial transactions that involve anything that's not cash. The easiest way to explain that is if you're shopping online, or if you're in a brick and mortar store, if you're Walmart, Amazon, Dunkin' Donuts, really, it doesn't matter where you are. As long as you're not paying cash, some part of that transaction or the entire transaction passes through the Fiserv network. If you've ever used a Clover point of sale terminal, or if you're shopping online and using some banking app to create a virtual credit card number, those are all services that Fiserv offers. And we are a truly global company, so you can see our services all around the world.
I think you said financial transactions globally.
Globally.
So yes. truly around the world. Okay. So
the truly around the world. We've got point of sale devices in Australia, in India, maybe in Africa, there might be spots where you might not find Fiserv. But what we like to say is, regardless of that, some point of that transaction probably passes through something that's connected to Fiserv.
I feel like the network I was on was just a little baby financial payment card network at this point, because we used to brag about, you know, $2 billion a day went through our data centers, but we only covered like North America. That was like Canada and the US, and that was kind of it at that point in time. You got a whole different game going on.
So one of the things that we like to say at the Fiserv network, we have covered in 2023, and this is a number that really blows a lot of people's minds. So last year, Fiserv did $2.3 trillion in transactions. We did 35.38 billion transactions. So imagine, right, $2 trillion passes through the Fiserv network on average every year. It's certainly a lot of money to talk about.
And it's, I think the big takeaway here is that the network is a critical component of the business.
So, you know, what's funny, I like to relate the story to the people that I work with and work for. My wife shares the office next door to me. Every time she goes into Quicken and a bank doesn't download, a credit card doesn't download, or something like that, she comes knocking on the door. What did you break now? I'm like, no, I didn't do anything. So it's just an example, right? And that's one of the things at Fiserv. We don't maintain the infrastructure for us. We maintain it for our customers. And every single person listening to this podcast right now, unless they are the one person on the planet who still does everything only in cash, including banking, they're a customer. And we're making sure we maintain the infrastructure from a security standpoint, from a compliance standpoint, to make sure your information is safe.
You are a multi-vendor shop, as I understand it. Can you talk about what vendors are in your network?
Absolutely. So we always make sure we choose best of breed solutions. So we're not, hey, we're only this vendor shop, we're only that vendor shop. So if you're looking for Cisco, Arista, Juniper, Versa, ExtraHop, if you're looking for ServiceNow, if you're looking for essentially, you name it, somewhere, Palo Alto, Checkpoint, I almost forgot my security vendors. If you're looking for any vendor, we've got it somewhere in our environment.
Okay.
Yeah, so it sounds like that means integration is a key issue for you as in terms of making sure this network is up and running properly.
it's more than just integration. So integration is really important, but we try to only operate with standards-based protocols. So whether it's, you know, BGP or .1Q or any standards-based protocol, but even in some cases, right, you know, one vendor's interpretation of BGP yeah. metrics might not be the same as another vendor's or yeah. or VXLAN. VXLAN is a standard. Anything that's VXLAN can talk to anything else VXLAN, as long as it comes from the same vendor and it's in the same code base. But putting that aside, one of the things that automation is really critical to us for is lowering the bar to entry to building that infrastructure, because we have such a variety of platforms. And you also didn't include public cloud, right? So AWS, GCP, mm-hmm. Azure, right. Those are also additional platforms to keep in mind. Additionally, other platforms that you want to automate. And there's no way any single engineer can know all of those platforms enough. So building any end-to-end automation workstream requires that the engineers and the platforms take all of that into account.
It's funny what you say about can't keep it all in your head anymore. No single engineer can keep it all in their head to be able to build that up, because that didn't used to be the case. It used to be that you could, I could keep whatever it was in my head end to end, especially if I built it. And it's gotten to the point where, practically speaking, you can't. There's too much going on. There's too many variations. And now you add in cloud and multi-cloud and the big cloud service providers. No, you practically speaking, you cannot keep it all in your head. Not unless you're willing to risk screwing things up a lot.
So absolutely, you can't keep it all in your head. I can remember, you know, back when I got my IE January 9th, 2000. So anybody listening knows how old I must really be. I knew all of the iOS commands I needed off the top of my head, because you couldn't carry the CCO CD. Everybody remembers getting in Cisco training the CD, and it used to be yep. the most treasured thing. You couldn't keep that or carry that into the test with you. You had to know or be able to just use the question mark. And in today's environment, there's no way anyone can do that.
So we're having an automation conversation, and you tried automation a few times in the past and weren't quite successful. Can you sort of walk us through what didn't work the first few times around?
So don't copy my painful decisions. One of the things that we did from an automation perspective was we went and we hired consultants, and this is not to disparage the consultants themselves, but rather the way the consultants were integrated into the daily workflow and efforts of the engineers. A lot of the use cases didn't have any real functional value for the engineers who we were trying to enable from an automation perspective. What we also did, though, was give all of the engineers Python training, and that Python training and Ansible training and Autobot training and NetBox training and Postman training. Every engineer was put through that. And what happened was, because they didn't have the training to identify immediate use cases, because they didn't make it part of their daily work, because it didn't change what their daily work was, 3-6 months in, only the engineers who were like, wow, I can transform things with this, and that's what, maybe 2-3%. The rest of the engineers, because of their workload, just put that knowledge aside and continued doing things the way they were doing before.
Is that because when you get into network automation at scale, and it's more than just writing a simple script that replaces something you used to do by hand, but you're actually trying to build a system, you really got to have everybody on board?
Absolutely. So when you look at building network automation at scale, and it's important to understand, for me, scale doesn't mean necessarily changing thousands of devices at once, because I'll tell you, I come from a production environment where anytime we want to change any significant number of devices, it's a very, very rare occasion to get all those change approvals through the system to be able to make that kind of impact in one change window. So when we say scale, what we're looking for is the ability to scale across all the different platforms that we have. We're looking for scale to move across and into all of these systems that feed into the information that's necessary to be successful in our automation journey.
So if I can poke a little bit, you said some automation kind of dictates were handed down from above, but they didn't actually align with what network engineering needed. So can you talk about where the differential was? What is it that, you know, some business executive thought automation should be versus what actually needed to happen?
Absolutely. It's actually one of my favorite questions. So there's a significant misconception, to me at least, and in engineers I've spoken to and others I've shared this with, that engineers don't need a lot of help on pushing configuration files, right? Because what do you, SSH to a box, copy and paste. And although you shouldn't do that in today's environment with automation, how much time does that really save if you're only looking at the push effort? So what we really focused on is where the engineers were spending the most amount of their time, because identifying where they're spending the most amount of their time is what would give you the most benefit. So what we found is that engineers spend the most amount of their time actually creating the engineering artifacts, the configuration files, what VLAN I'm going to assign, what subnet I'm going to pull from, what's the naming convention I need to use for this particular model of device, what's the VRF that I need to assign that device into. So what we found was actually by lowering the cost of data, and this is a mantra we say over and over again, by lowering the cost of data, we were able to enable the engineers to do more by doing less.
Okay, so their vision of automation was let's push these configs faster, but for the network engineering team, it was more about let's have structured processes in place around essential network data?
Essentially. So one of the things it's funny because I actually heard this in a Packet Pushers podcast many years ago, was focused around the source of truth or system of record or where you're getting your information from. So for us, it became critical to make sure that when an engineer needed to do something, we've got to add new VLAN to a switch. Hold on, I SSH to the 10 switches that I know of, and I found the VLAN number that's not being used. Excellent. There are 12 switches, and that's just in that one pod. And oh, by the way, the VLAN that you picked happens to be a transit VLAN that you didn't see on those 10 switches because it's only on these two. And now that you added it to those other 10 became transit. You created a spanning tree loop and happy day, the wires are warm. So that's the kind of mistake that engineers make. And it's called an incident caused by change, which again, going back to what you said earlier, there's no way with having over 20,000 network devices, any engineer can say without knowing that they actually know anything. So gathering that information, putting it in a place that could be updated via automation, making sure it's a repository engineers trust, because again, it comes right from the systems themselves, not an engineer typing on a keyboard. Because how many times have you gone to record the version of code? I'll put the dot here. I'll put the parentheses there. And then suddenly it's not the same version of code, but it actually is. So those were the things that we really focused on.
And these are great examples. A lot of times we like to think about this as kind of my, you know, automation for myself. You guys talked about Python scripts, automations for my team and automations for my organization. And I think a lot of the use cases, you know, Michael's talking about is how do we get teams to work together? And with all these pockets of automation, whether we're building with Python scripts or getting controllers from our equipment vendors, I think one of the things that's often overlooked is how do these teams functionally work together? You know, a lot of times we joke about, will you share your automation with the person sitting next to you versus a person you don't know in the organization? You know, most people will share with the person sitting next to them, but they're fearful of somebody they don't know running their automation. And a lot of what Michael's talking about is really how do we foster a community and how do we build trust between teams so that we can share automations to kind of build on orchestration towards larger goals, we think is super useful.
But it's not just about trust. It's about trust founded on accuracy of information about the network as a whole, about network state.
Exactly.
Yes. One of the things that we used to do in the past, and we had some success with automation in the past, but that was engineers developing, as I said before, Python scripts or Ansible playbooks for themselves, right? So they're increasing and improving their daily work, but that doesn't scale across an entire organization. And when you start to introduce some of the principles of a CI/CD pipeline to engineers and you try to teach them Git, you try to teach them GitHub or GitLab or any of the variations of a CI/CD pipeline or Jenkins or test suites, that's where you start to run into the challenges of a network engineer doesn't start out as a software developer, but you can't go to a software developer and write just network automation without understanding how the network operates. So that was one of the significant challenges that we've been trying to overcome.
You did get to a point before you brought iTential in-house, you did get to a point where you had a successful automation practice. Not everything, but not everything was like a fully mature practice, but it was somewhat successful, Michael, from what you've told us. Could you describe how far did you get with that somewhat successful practice?
So where we got with that somewhat successful practice is we have a job runner, right? So it's not Ansible or Ansible Tower. We have another platform that we can use to run jobs that are automation. It's not very good at coordinating the different jobs. It's not very good at leveraging information from external sources natively. It's not very good at consuming existing automation or APIs natively. And what that means, by I keep emphasizing that word, is all of those bits and pieces and parts had to be written as part of the automation flow. So if you had two jobs or you had two things you want to do, is another way to say it, and you wanted them to be able to talk to each other, then they had to do that externally to this platform. There was no native way for them to share information from one job to another. So in examples where you're trying to validate information on an external system, that works well and good within one long script. But if you're done and you're trying to do some post checks that require checking outside of the script, or if you want to be able to reuse as individual components some of the automation that you've written, again, it becomes very cumbersome because you have to write automation to call other automation or to call other systems or to call APIs. It wasn't natively built into the system. And we started to hit some speed bumps, some ceiling height, where it was really challenging us to write all of that additional bits and pieces. And the platform wasn't focused on network automation. And I know that for some folks, well, automation is automation, right? You're just deploying a script or you're running a playbook. Network automation has an understanding that network engineers are not software developers and tries to use newer technologies like low code and no code in order to lower the bar of entry so that engineers who are just starting out can still make use of an automation platform.
So we've talked a lot technically about where you'd gotten to. What about organizationally? Did you have to make team changes, do reorganization and so on to get to have the success that you had that far?
Yeah. So one of the interesting things about this, right, is, as I said, we started with consultants, right? They came in, they fished, everybody ate, they left, we starved. And then we tried building a center of automation excellence that was centralized for the entire infrastructure organization. And the problem with that is prioritization. The problem with that is the folks who are doing it are not network engineers. Or if you pull your network engineers out of the organization they're in doing engineering and move them into just purely an automation play, then they end up, well, because they're subject matter experts, say an SD-WAN automation, but then they're given a ticket in their automation team to work on automation that's focused, say, on a data center or identity and access management. So what we did was we built an automation team or center of excellence as a product within the networking space. So all of the folks that are part of that team have some understanding of networking. They've all been through, you know, whether it's the basic CCNA courses or the basic Arista courses or Juniper courses, they've got some starting ground of understanding of networking. So when you're telling them to write some automation that can look at static routes on a bunch of routers and find the next hop. So if I change here, I know that I need to change there in the other place. If you have someone who has a basic understanding and then really good automation skills, they can get those use cases and run and do that on their own. And the prioritization gets set based on what the networking team needs, but we can still leverage some of the shared platforms like ServiceNow.
So why did you then start talking to iTential? What were you hoping to accomplish by bringing in another platform?
So One of the things we're trying to do is reduce platform sprawl. So you just said bringing in another platform. Yeah. Doesn't that increase your platform sprawl? One of the things we were looking for is something that somewhere down the road, could we potentially replace our go do this platform? And that's really a basic feature and function. What we really wanted was we wanted something that gave us the ability for low code, no code. So engineers who are not experts yet in writing Python or creating Ansible playbooks or consuming APIs from almost every platform today comes out with an API set, they could still make use of automation. So by having something that lowered the bar of entry, by having something that enabled us to, and this is a big part of the iTential idea, is reuse what we already built, lower the bar of entry, and create the ability to, without having to write wrappers for everything, create a workflow of multiple automation things, right? So instead of just writing an automation thing that, say, deploys a VLAN onto a switch, which that doesn't sound that hard. Okay, wait. You got to check the source of truth. Make sure that the VLAN in that source of truth doesn't exist. Or if it does exist, make sure you're using the same VLAN name. Make sure you're using the same description for the VLAN, assuming it's in the same spanning tree domain. And if it's not in the same spanning tree domain, make sure that the system understands that. So there's a lot of pre-checks around that. What that also does then is that it gives us the ability to enforce a standard naming convention, enforce a standard. And again, standards make things easier to automate as we go down the road. So summarize, bring in iTential, lower the bar of entry. It enabled us to reuse automation that we'd already built, and it accelerated our ability to deliver automation because the iTential adapter concept can actually pull in APIs from all the different platforms we have, whether it's Forward Networks or Aristas or it's Versa or Cisco, it doesn't matter. It can pull all of that in and expose those adapters and API calls so that engineers who don't know how to make an API call can actually use them as part of their automation workflow and create cute little front ends, not fancy front ends, but front ends that were good enough to take the input from other engineers as they were using it. So what that enabled is that enabled us to let the engineers build automation that is not just self-serving, but can be used to serve a broader audience of all the engineers because it's feeding from one source and done in just a certain set way.
It, just to add on, I will say that I think I talk about this a lot, but that the market has evolved to the point that allows Michael to do these things, I think is something we always need to focus on, in the sense that the reason we can build all these adapters to all these systems is these vendors are producing open API specifications of how to consume their APIs, right? Mm-hmm. The data models for their inputs and outputs are JSON schema. You know, we're getting more controller and programmable interfaces than we've ever had before. And we're seeing consolidation in the DevOps community around things like Python and Ansible and Terraform. And what that allows vendors like iTential and Michael to do is to be able to consolidate these so we can have a lot of reusability. So if we're opening up ServiceNow tickets, if we're doing change management windows, if we're pulling data from sources of truth, we can have a single interface that aggregates different automation domains instead of each automation domain having to rebuild that over and over. So we really think it's important to think about it as a federated capacity where each team has their own capacity to automate in the way they choose, whether it's high code with Python or low code with drag and drop workflows, but they can leverage consistency in how they operate automation versus consistency in the automation. So people might have different templates. People might have different ways of working. SD-WAN's very different from data center, but how we open up tickets, how we self-serve automations, how we tie these things together, make it reusable, how we test can be consistently done so we can scale operationally and not just scale, as Michael said, through pushing config to hundreds or thousands of devices.
So, we just said a lot of things there. Michael, one of the things you said was you develop a workflow. And so I'm imagining, you know, in my head, as you're building out an automation, there's a lot of, there's, if I'm going the low code approach, I can use the Itential, you guys say Canvas, right? That's
Canvas,
the right term.
Or I like wireframe diagrams. It's not their marketing term, but I like a wireframe diagram because that's how we build most of our flows. That's what I think in either a mind map or a wireframe diagram, because as an architect, I don't draw the actual boxes as they're supposed to be. I just draw boxes.
But as the architecture of that automation is drawn out on that canvas, then that wireframe, now I've got more thought that's going on my part as an engineer. It's not just I'm creating a VLAN. Here's a script that does that. Bang. It's all of this other built around it. So I understand context. I now understand if the VLAN I'm trying to create is existing in some other place and I shouldn't do that. And so on. You're checking against a system of record, or as you prefer, Michael, over source of truth, I think we found out prepping for this recording. And now I can do all that easily without having to be a developer. And I would never have to be a developer if I didn't want to be as a network engineer, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So one of the things we invested in parallel or earlier than the Itential platform was digital twin technology. So now imagine I've got a digital replica of everything in my infrastructure, not just the configuration files, but also the end-to-end paths and the MAC tables, the ARP tables, CAM tables, all of that, the firewall rules, the load balance scripts, all of that goodness in a database that's API accessible. So I can ask it questions. So now when the engineer goes to provision, pull in on that VLAN example, a VLAN on a switch, and let's say it's using VXLAN. So the VLAN follows downstream to the vSwitch, to the ESXi host, and the VLAN is tied to a VNI, which is tied to a Verve, which is tied to an SVI, which is tied to an Anycast gateway, right? So all of that in the data center, imagine the engineer would have to gather that information manually. And I'm a human. I make a lot of mistakes, just ask my wife. All of those mistakes that are made would create an incident caused by change. It had nothing to do with the engineer not knowing what they're doing. They could sit and, you know, espouse to you the TLVs inside of a VXLAN header. I can't do that anymore. I used to be able to, but I used to. And they can explain that to you. But that doesn't mean they're not going to make a mistake in that VLAN to VNI mapping. So having that information now exposed as part of a workflow where the information gets pulled in and the engineer just says, yes, I see that, and you write the logic, right? Keep following, write the logic that picks the next available VLAN number. The engineer says, here's what this VLAN does. It creates a description based on our standards. It maps that all across the infrastructure. And even if you don't want to use it to push, you're going to have to just spit out the configuration file that's necessary to put on all those devices. We use it to push as well. But again, trying to really focus on the fact is not pushing configs, but making sure the engineer is doing things in a way that doesn't introduce any incidents, that doesn't introduce any creativity. You had a podcast a couple of weeks ago about, you know, down with the network cowboys. I've been saying this for years. Network engineering is not an art. It should be a standard. You should follow policies and procedures. And the only time creativity should come into play is when you're trying to deal with something that doesn't follow a standard.
Oh, that's one of my favorite things that you said there. Does not introduce any creativity. I absolutely love that. I never heard it put that way, and it's just perfect. It's really good. We've talked about workflow, but we haven't talked about automation practice maturity. Would you say your automation practice is mature at this point, Michael?
So I will say that my automation practice is maturing. Our automation practice, I try to keep a CI/CD mindset. Nothing is ever done. We reach a milestone. We use minimum viable products. We use an agile mindset because it works better. Because one of the things we found in our practice is when you break an engineering problem down into smaller bits and pieces, you find more things that are reusable. We find more things that we can repeat and make standards out of. And it gives us the ability to track progress so that if in the event you hit a roadblock, right, you can't get your change deployed because change management won't approve it, or you're waiting for a bug scrub to come back from a vendor, I can look at the agile process and know which part of the work effort is currently being blocked or currently needs to be started again. And then the next time we do it, improve, reuse. So adapting that kind of mindset, a CI/CD mindset, has given us the ability to, again, increase our velocity through which we're delivering the engineering without, this is the part that I like to say to the network engineers, asking them to do more, right? So one of the other things about cost of data and reducing it is we enable our engineers to do more by actually doing less. And who doesn't want to make their kids soccer game or baseball game or football, right, whatever sport they play, because you don't have to spend those hours SSHing to 100 switches.
But when you buy a tool, when you buy a new tool, I bought a lot of them, there's inevitably more work, or it feels that way. That's been my experience a lot of times. You're telling me that's not the case in this instance.
So what I'll say is that I don't lose weight by simply saying I'm just not going to eat for one day, right? So it takes time. It is a progression. Yeah. Yes, at the outset, there will be more work. At the outset, you will need a team focused on building and delivering the platform. So we have a small team that is focused on building and delivering the platform, focused on pulling in all of the existing automation, focused on pulling in all of the APIs from our different vendors to build adapters. By the way, Itential has a long library of adapters already available, so you don't have to reinvent the wheel for everything. And yes, there is initial work, but the payoff when you're done, and we're only, say, 6 months maybe into our initial Itential build, run, and deployment, and we're already seeing benefit in our initial use cases.
It sounds like you could take this platform and use it for almost anything. How did you decide what to aim it at sort of out of the gate?
So that's a really good question. So what we decided to aim it out of the gate was at software upgrades. Okay, everybody out there is going, software upgrades, really? You just SCP file to a router or a switch and you need automation to do that? Yeah, okay. So, but wait. So let me ask you a question this way. How many times have you done a software upgrade to an AB pair and the B goes, what do you mean I'm supposed to take over to A? I had somebody configure me to do something different once and, well, I don't play in that AB game anymore. Or, hey, by the way, did you know the VLANs on the switch are not the same as the trunk statement on the opposite side? There's no port group created, or there is a port group created for a VLAN that's on the northbound side, but not on the southbound side. Oh, wait, this device hasn't had a BGP peer with the upstream router in how many weeks, months? I don't know. We stopped, we suppressed those notifications to the NOC because we were getting them too often. So those are the things that are necessary, just or didn't even talk about, is there enough space on the device to hold the OS, right? Those are the basic things that are necessary, not, again, to push software to the box, because that's basic. Like pushing config to a router, that's basic. I don't need help with that. I need help with the surrounding pieces. And when we are looking at an automation workflow, for those surrounding pieces to validate that we can understand the software upgrade will be successful, because everything, not everything, but anything an engineer shared with us in the past that caused the software upgrade to fail is being checked during the automated software upgrade process. So now I don't have to depend on an engineer to do those checks. Imagine down the road, you can not just have an engineer review the outputs of those checks, but potentially use some other tool, and I have to put it in there, AI or ML, to analyze the output and say immediately, I don't need the engineer to tell me to stop, because we notice that the route count or the default route or the insert whatever error causes the thing to blow up here will prevent this from being successful? This job has been aborted. Or wait, even better, can we run those commands or those tests, say, prior to that execution happening? So maybe you know where you will and won't be successful, and you know what remediation is necessary to be successful all the way across the board. So yes, software upgrades more complicated than just pushing code.
How does this look for, do you have people that are consuming these services beyond just the network engineering team? Are you publishing services that other folks in your organization are using to get things done?
That's really a great question. So one of the other things going along with the lowering the cost of data, I'm a developer, I'm writing an app, I'm putting that app in AWS, and I want to make sure that that app can reach a data center in North America where I got a workload running. Let me open up an engineering ticket. Oh, engineering's backlogged. Oh, man. All right. How long am I going to have to wait for an engineer to, because I ran Traceroute. Traceroute died midway through. Why? Because there's an overlay and an underlay and an overlay and an underlay. And Traceroute doesn't understand all those things, right? So if we could imagine now, give our developers a portal that gives them access to that information, where they can extract that information. And when they put in maybe their app name, we can go in, again, using automation, have it query ServiceNow and make sure the application is actually registered. Because by the way, even if you can get from here to there, if your application isn't registered, when you go to put in a firewall request, they'll reject you right out of hand. Oh, hey, your application is not registered. You need to register with CMDB? Here's a link. Or if you look at the firewall rule. So here's the firewall you're going to need to ask to have modified. And here's the rule you either need added or modified. And because in a lot of cases, to secure infrastructure, we feel the need to put firewalls in more places than there may be necessary, knowing all the firewalls in the path, again, all of this delivered through automation to an audience that doesn't know what the difference is between config T or enable mode or any of those things that you know as an engineer.
So Itential becomes a key piece for a self-service capability, an internal service catalog.
Yeah, and you know what that does? That means the engineer who is answering those questions doesn't have to answer those questions anymore. What can they do? They can do more actual engineering.
Chris, Michael talked a lot of the different features that he's bringing in. And one of the things he talked about was integration. Lots of different platforms, lots of things happening there, adapters and so on. I'm curious how you're delivering that. Are you just consuming an API and then doing magic and you guys make it all happen? Is it, what's going on there?
Yeah, so there's a couple of core building blocks that I think are worth visiting. So, you know, something you were mentioning with the wireframe, we call Automation Studio, is each of those blocks is automation. So when we look at that canvas, it's really about tying together and coordinating your automation. And one reason that customers can get started so quickly is that we want to leverage what you already have. That came up earlier, right? So if you have existing automations, usually there's pockets of automation. You know, we can onboard those into our product called IAG, Automation Gateway. So taking your Python scripts, your Ansible playbooks, your Terraform plans, et cetera, and onboarding those become those building blocks that you can tie together. And then for the API systems that we talked about, we have those 220 adapters that Michael referenced, largely driven off of open API spec. So shout out to all the vendors that are keeping those up to date. With 3.1 in open API spec, it actually models the schema, both the input and the output, which is super robust. And what that allows us to do is federate all of those systems and bring them in. So while Itential might not out of the box understand AWS versus versa, we onboard those open API specs. We now know how to talk to those systems. So that allows Michael's team to tie those bricks together. And then the part that's challenges.
Hang on, Chris. Yep. It's an important piece here. You said onboard those APIs. Is that an easy thing, or is that there's a team of engineers at Itential that spend several months on it and then the integration's done?
It's so easy, even I can do it.
Thank you, Michael. So the system allows you to basically dump that open API spec directly into the system, and it will auto-ingest it, and then they just show up in your canvas. For ones that have more complicated specs or not on the latest spec, we have an integration builder, if you will. So you upload it, you answer a few questions, and it generates the code for you. There's nobody at iTential writing any integrations with systems. That is the benefit of the industry, is that we can auto-generate those, which we think has really pushed the entire industry forward, regardless of iTential. But once you tie those bricks together, what people, you know, what we found out about 3 years ago, and I think what people find out as they go through their automation journey, is that the way things like InfoBlocks model an IP address, ServiceNow models an IP address, et cetera, are not the same. And there's a lot of industry bodies talking about data modeling and data modeling standards. Mm-hmm. That's a show all to itself. But what we think is critically as important is that we do data transformation. So you have the API integration, which I just said is out of the box. And then we have this data transformation system so that I can take one model and map it to another model, which really ends up being a bulk of the code when you do kind of a high code strategy. So, you know, just in summary, it's onboarding your existing automations, which typically are very high code. They show up as bricks in the canvas, onboard adapters to your API systems. Now you kind of have everything in the same design studio, tie them together, and then do that data transformation. And that really allows you to build that end-to-end orchestrated concept. And then, as Michael said, over time, you can add things to it. So maybe you get an observability platform, you want to plug that in. Maybe you're doing pcerts with Cisco for upgrades, you plug that in. So it's really this incremental orchestrated approach that as you get more systems that can speak programmatically, you can kind of stitch them into your framework over time.
So Michael, I think I got one more question for you, which is where is Fiserv going next with iTential?
So one of the things I mentioned earlier is self-service. For us, it would be critical as we grow and as we accelerate our adoption for more platforms, for public cloud, containers, for software-defined networking, SD-WAN, SASE, pick a Gartner acronym, and we'll be investing in it at some point. Looking at all of those things, but not creating more work for the engineers, only happens if you lead with an automation mindset. Instead of having it a follow-on, now that we built it, how do we automate it? How do we only build through automation? Because if you do that, then that means everything you built is standardized. And if you do that, then that means you can trust the information that you have about that system. And if you can do that, then you can figure out how to enable self-service for not the engineers, but for the folks who are trying to actually build a VM guest, right? You go on AWS or Azure or whatever cloud platform, they'll ask you what VLAN you want to be assigned to. So I want to remove that layer of information from someone who's requesting a VM. I want you to request a VM or a workload or an app, be able to tell us what security posture it needs to have. Is it internet facing? Does it have PII data? Is it internal only? And then based on those pieces of information, which are the same things an engineer would ask for, be able to then go and leverage our automation platform through self-service to build standardized infrastructure constructs that deliver that service in a matter of minutes without ever having to contact an engineer. So in the future, it's self-service.
It'll require you guys to be a little more opinionated about the way things are getting done and just putting that layer in, that additional abstraction layer. And so that there's certain question you don't have to think about, you don't have to care about. We're just going to deliver you the service.
Exactly. And to my engineer friends, if I scared you with what I said, because I said you didn't need to call an engineer, I'm serious. One of the things I'm talking to all the junior engineers about in our organization is focus on being a thought leader. Focus on looking at the tools and the infrastructure that you have and understanding how you can do more. So just want to close out with a previous leader said to me, and this is the mindset I adopt from a business perspective whenever I look at any new tool or platform, I can't move forward unless in an elevator ride, you've got the ability to tell me how you pull one of three levers. You either make me more money, you save me money, or you keep me off the front page of the newspaper. If you ask me about iTential, I will say iTential will make us more money by increasing our velocity to deliver infrastructure. It will save us money because to deliver more, I won't need any significant increase in headcount. And it keeps me off the front page of the newspaper by allowing me to ensure the infrastructure is consistently secured everywhere, no matter whether it's a CPE that's at a retail store, or it's an internet-facing router that's terminating VPNs, or it's something that's a workload in public cloud. It gives me that ability to deliver consistency and pull all three levers at the same time.
Okay. That's usually you don't get to pull all three. Usually it's like, you know, two of three, one of three, maybe.
Two of three. Yeah.
You're suggesting all three get pulled. That's a bold statement. Michael, if people have questions for you just about network automation at Fiserv generally or about iTential specifically, are you reachable online?
I am. So the easiest way to reach me online is to reach out to me via LinkedIn. I used to have a blog, but I found it's just too much work to maintain. So if you reach out to me on LinkedIn, just remember my name is spelled the wrong way. It's W-Y-N-S-T-O-N, because otherwise you'll find someone else. And the upside of that is if you type in Michael Winston, there's only one other person on LinkedIn, I think, that has the name spelled the same way, which is amazing when you think of how many people are now on LinkedIn. And most of them are ghost accounts. Don't accept from somebody who's very impressed by your profile. Chances are it's a ghost account. Anyway, if you reach out to me on LinkedIn or on Twitter, Mr. Winston or X now, I guess it's called, those are the easiest ways to get in touch with me.
Chris Wade, same question for you. How do people get in touch?
Definitely LinkedIn. And then we do have a landing page. So it's www.itential.com/packetpushers that has all of our previous episodes as well as this one and a way to engage with iTential.
Excellent. Thanks for being a sponsor again, iTential. Thanks to Fiserv for letting us chat with Michael. And if you ring up iTential to find out more about their platform, please make sure to let them know that you heard about them on the Packet Pushers podcast network. And thanks to you for listening all the way through. We appreciate that. Now, if Heavy Networking is the only show you listen to from our fine network of tech experts, you are missing out on shows like Heavy Wireless with Keith Parsons, Packet Protector, our brand new security show with JJ Minella and Drew Conry Murray, as well as Day 2 Cloud with Ned Bellavance and Kyler Middleton discussing all of your infrastructure operations needs. I have been Ethan Banks, along with Drew Conry Murray. You can follow or connect with us on LinkedIn, or you can chat with us on the Packet Pushers Slack group. Yeah, we got one of those. PacketPushers.net/community to join that Slack group. If you have comments about this show, send us some follow-up at packetpushers.net/FU. We love getting those follow-up comments from all of you. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.